Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
The arc of the moral universe. Who bends it? The answer is we bend it. In 1853, Theodore Parker, Unitarian minister and abolitionist who was a radical even among the abolitionists, spoke of the moral universe whose arc is long and bends toward justice. More than a century later, Martin Luther King Jr. declared the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And 2 years ago, the journalist Rebecca Solnit wrote an article about the arc of the moral universe for TomDispatch.com, saying sometimes Martin Luther King's arc of the moral universe that bends toward justice is so long few can see the curve. So what is this talk about bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice all about? Well, much of science tells us that the universe is impersonal and morally neutral. But to sound a bit like my 19th century predecessors, conscience and history tell us something else. There are, of course, different ways of knowing, and there are different kinds of truth. And the truth of which I speak today is moral, even if it sounds metaphorical, and just as true as scientific truth. The arc of the moral universe is something closer to my experience of human beings than an experience of an impersonal and neutral physical universe. And even in the difficult times in which we live today, we know that since the 1950s, that arc has bent toward justice. But we also know that there are persons and forces today trying to bend it back. So the question is, who bends the moral arc of the universe toward justice? And the answer is, we bend it. What was the experience of Parker in the 1850s and King in the 1960s? Such that they could assert the hope, even the deeply held belief, that the arc of the universe bends toward justice. Both were speaking in times of racism, economic injustice, and war. Parker's sermon of justice and the conscience reads rather analytically and abstractly by today's standards for sermons. It's full of ideas, but it fits in a historical context. In 1804, Haiti became the first colony to throw off European rule. An act of independence much celebrated amongst progressives and liberals of that era in the United States. In 1846 to 1848, there was widespread opposition to the Mexican War, including acts of civil disobedience. In 1848, there were revolutions in Europe, though not successful, proof of the will of people to rise up against oppression. And many of those who could no longer live in Germany because of their roles there came to the United States. And some of them became military officers, and one eventually an undersecretary in Lincoln's cabinet, and contributed a great deal towards the struggle here. In fact, one of those German military officers was a U.S. military officer when effort was made to take over the United States Armory in St. Louis, and he led the forces that defended it. 1850, the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, a major step backward. In the midst of the period from 1830 to 1860, when tens and possibly 100,000 slaves came to the North in Canada via the Underground Railroad. But with the Fugitive Slave Act, though enacted, was widely disobeyed. And there was Parker in 1853 looking at this and saying, yes, there are steps forward and steps backward, but the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice. Between Parker's death in 1860 and King's rise to prominence just under a century later, there was more history. The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, bringing about emancipation, followed by the enfranchisement of black men as voters. There was Reconstruction. Then there was a demolition of Reconstruction and the establishment of Jim Crow racism, and the growth of both legal and de facto segregation. The Klan rose up and terrorized people across the country. Then there was the populist movement, sometimes racist, sometimes not, but fighting against economic inequality. And then beginning in the 1880s, the golden age, when corporations dominated everything, the rise of the labor movement, striking back at those corporations and fighting for the rights of working people, a movement that peaked in the 1950s. There were two world wars. There was the New Deal. There was the Cold War. And even before King became prominent, the beginnings of a labor and civil rights coalition. Prophetic words and deeds proved true and effective. And justice triumphed, not steadily, not all the time, but now and again and bit by bit, bending the arc toward justice. And during King's public career, the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott, the 1963 March for Jobs and Justice and Freedom. Freedom, jobs, and justice. You know, people remember King's speech from that, about the dream and all of that, and forget that a big part of the point of that march was jobs. 64, Freedom Summer, white college students going to the South and working on voter registration. And King's receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, which led him to miss an event he very much wanted to attend, a dinner in honor of Norman Thomas's 80th birthday, the head of the Socialist Party who had run for president several times and had gotten more votes as a third-party candidate than anyone before or since in U.S. history. But King wrote an essay in honor of Thomas's 80th birthday titled "The Bravest Man in the World." 1965, the Selma to Montgomery March, and following that, the introduction of civil rights legislation by President Lyndon Johnson. At the same time, growing opposition to the war in Vietnam, which King joined in vocally in 1967, and then gave an increasing emphasis to poor people's rights and the Poor People's Campaign, and was supporting sanitation workers striking in Memphis when he was assassinated in 1968. His last speech, which is called a sermon in some texts, was actually a speech to a union gathering in a church in Memphis. His "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, who had organized the garbage workers in Memphis. Prophetic truth-telling and action, such as King exemplified, can stir a great deal of support, but it can also stir opposition and lose supporters from previous efforts. Once King came out against the war in Vietnam, which he saw as a racist war as well as an imperialist war, he lost some of his labor and political support. A lot of good labor jobs were in the war industries. And a lot of the unions had chafed under his criticism of their whiteness and unwillingness to integrate. even as they supported voting rights. But from the start, King was clear that there were three evils in the world and they were connected. Speaking to the 1960 convention of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union District 65, King said there are three major social evils: the evil of war, the evil of economic injustice, and the evil of racial injustice. And although racial injustice is the one most of us remember, he always connected them. Coretta Scott King told Cornel West of the start of her and Martin's relationship. He quotes her as saying, "On my first date with Martin, I was surprised because I'd never met a black socialist before." But he was. King's connections with the peace movement, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and socialism go back to his early days. And it's an interesting biographical fact that he grew up in relative comfort in the solid black middle class of Atlanta. And for the first time saw poverty up front when, as a college student, he took a summer job harvesting tobacco in the tobacco fields that used to exist east of Hartford, Connecticut, and saw extreme poverty among white farming families there. And that, interestingly enough, sparked his interest in economic justice. Now, whereas Theodore Parker in the 1800s was full of vitriol, King's nonviolence demanded that he love the enemy. Use force, soul force, as Gandhi put it, but love the enemy. Love the person. His idea of a loving personal God demonstrated what human beings needed to do. And this is what he said in his speech titled Beyond Vietnam in 1967, and I quote, "Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence. When it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves, for from his view we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition. And if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of brothers who are called the opposition." Justice, in King's view, could not be complete without reconciliation. The triumph of civil rights laws, yes, was good. Civil rights laws changed behaviors, but they did not bring about reconciliation between adversaries. Nonetheless, because of the civil rights laws, two generations later, children and young people are growing up in a world that is much different. But it's still clear that we have not achieved the beloved community of which King spoke. After two generations of changed behaviors, many hearts remain unchanged. We see the hearts unchanged in the virulent denial over the last 7 years that Barack Obama is a legitimate president. That is racism, pure and simple. We see the reality of hearts unchanged and pushback in what Michelle Alexander has labeled the new Jim Crow, the use of imprisonment to disenfranchise black males. The disenfranchise of mostly black voters in places like Florida and other states, partly through the use of felony convictions to prevent people becoming voters again after completing their terms and finishing parole, and partly through the use of IDs that are burdensome for people who are poor or rurally isolated or racially isolated. The increased keeping of guns at home and carrying them in public, as if the white man's frontier had returned. And I see the changes in open carry laws and people like who called themselves militia. And I remember some 45 or so years ago when a group of black students carried guns onto a college campus saying, "We are not safe here with all these white people around us." And the horror that arose from that, a much greater horror than we see with these open carry laws and the spread of weapons. Indeed, we live in a time where there seems to be a wave of violence. The list of names of black men and black teenagers, even black children who have been killed by police is too long. Trayvon Martin in Florida, Eric Garner on Staten Island, Tamir Rice in Cleveland are just three. There are many more. Many more. Those in the Black Lives Matter movement are rightfully angry, but they're not violent. And the Black Lives Matter movement is a manifestation of that same struggle that's been going on since slavery dominated this country. Anger is seething around this country, in part because, with few exceptions, we have never done the work of truth and reconciliation that the Union of South Africa did in an effort not to blow up after the change in regimes and not to let old angers and hatreds prevent a new reality from developing. There's one noteworthy example of that in the United States in Greensboro, North Carolina, where a group of Klan, with the cooperation of the police, shot and killed a racially diverse group of demonstrators. 1978, I think it was. And people in that community have stayed and worked on that and done processes of truth and reconciliation in order to rebuild that community and move beyond that violence. The threat of violence against African Americans is nothing new. I've mentioned it here before, but the first time I was involved in struggles with the police around misconduct and violence towards young black males was in the 1970s in Los Angeles. It's not news, but the news is getting better showing it. In the 1850s, the Reverend Theodore Parker kept a loaded gun in the pulpit. Why? Because black members of his congregation had escaped slavery and could be returned under the Fugitive Slave Act. And he made it clear that if anyone wanted to kidnap any members of his congregation, they were going to have to get past the minister. He was not going to let them be taken away. And we know today that something is happening that bends the moral arc away from justice. There's a lot of it. But the struggle to bend towards justice continues. In recent years, we've seen the Occupy movement take on economic injustice. And although it seems to have disappeared, the conversation about economic injustice has changed. We see arising in the last 2 years, Black Lives Matter. Like King, insisting on bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice. So again, I ask the question, I want you to answer it this time. Who bends the arc of the moral universe? We bend it. Yeah. Now, Parker and King saw the arc of the moral universe as God's work, but both felt compelled to work for justice. And if you've ever... I may have been the only one here who's read King's doctoral dissertation, but it's well worth reading. It's about the nature of God. And it's very interesting because it helps us understand how, although he believed in a personal, loving, justice-making God, he understood that human beings had to do the work. Both of these men felt compelled for justice, to work for justice, and they were not alone. They built up congregations and other organizations as manifestations and driving forces to create what King has called the beloved community, to build the beloved community in the world at large. The beloved community is a just world in which all persons can share equitably in the wealth of the world and freely develop their gifts and their potentials in solidarity with one another, where they can disagree with respect, when they can live together in freedom. And neither of these heroes, one from one century and the other from another, did this work alone. Parker had good friends who were also in the struggle. Henry David Thoreau, who not only spent 2 years at Walden Pond, but was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. Louisa May Alcott, who not only wrote children's books and listened attentively to Parker's sermons when she was a young working woman in Boston, but was a Civil War nurse and a lonely voice in favor of interracial marriage when even most of the abolitionists were scared of that. Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom Cornel West called the greatest literary figure of 19th century America, spoke out against slavery, though not in the rousing voice of his good friend Theodore Parker, but did much more behind the scenes. When Henry David Thoreau knocked on his door late at night and said, "Waldo, I need your horse and buggy," Waldo said, "I knew what it was for," and said, "Of course." It was one more stage of the Underground Railroad. And Parker was among those who raised funds for John Brown's attempted guerrilla war against slavery. And King had many colleagues and allies in the struggle. His closest advisors and comrades included Fred Shuttlesworth, Ralph Abernathy, and James Lawson, who continued the struggle the rest of their lives long after King was dead. Thousands joined them on marches and boycotts in jail and in the struggle. And when you think about how easy it would be for a black man to disappear from a jail and be lynched, it is amazing how brave that civil disobedience was. When the call to Selma was issued, many Unitarian Universalist ministers answered the call, including the Reverend James Reeb, who was killed in Selma, and in whose memory this congregation's office and classroom building next door is named. Now, many of you have bent the arc of the moral universe toward justice. Many of you have been involved in civil rights, in the anti-war movement, in the reproductive rights movement, in the work for immigration reform, GLBTQ rights, and your ongoing engagement in and support for the People's Organization for Progress. I could go on, but I just want to say it's a slow bending. It was 90 years from the end of the Civil War to Brown v. Board of Education and the Montgomery bus boycott. Do we have to keep bending it? We do. We do. Just 2 years ago, when Rebecca Solnit wrote at length about the arc, she talked about Henry David Thoreau. I quote her, "Henry David Thoreau wrote books that not many people read when they were published. He famously said of his unsold copies, 'I now have a library of nearly 900 volumes, over 700 of which I wrote myself.'" But a South African lawyer of Indian descent named Mohandas Gandhi read Thoreau on civil disobedience and found ideas that helped him fight discrimination in Africa and then liberate his own country from British rule. Martin Luther King studied Thoreau and Gandhi and put their ideas to work in the United States. While in 1852, the African National Congress and the young Nelson Mandela were collaborating with the South African Indian Congress on civil disobedience campaigns. You wish you could write Thoreau a letter about all this. He had no way of knowing that what he planted would still be bearing fruit 151 years after his death. She concludes, "But the past doesn't need us. The past guides us. The future needs us. Bending the arc of the moral universe is not a weekend project. As I.F. Stone famously said, if you've taken on a problem you can solve in your own lifetime, you haven't taken on a big enough problem. And that's why I put Parker and King's rhetoric in the context of history. We see that they possessed what the Unitarian minister Stephen Hole Fritchman, who was one of my models and mentors, called revolutionary patience. We must have revolutionary patience. Of more recent struggles, Solnit wrote, nearly 3 years after the first sparks of the Arab Spring began, it's wiser to consider it too barely begun rather than ended in failure. More than 2 years after the first members of Occupy Wall Street began decamping in Zuccotti Park, that movement is not over either, though almost all the encampments have subsided and the engagement has new names, Occupy Sandy, Strike Debt, and more. That everything continues to metamorphose seems a better way to think of social upheavals than obituaries and epitaphs. Black Lives Matter began less than 2 years ago, and it has already bent the arc of the moral universe toward justice. There are times when we feel the furious rush of history forward. They're rare, but from time to time we feel them. In the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, we felt them. But more often it feels as if we're being pulled backward. And a lot of the time that's how it feels today. But the arc of the moral universe is long and it does bend toward justice. The work of bending is not just a matter of winning battles on issues. It is a matter of changing hearts, including our own. So I ask you again, who bends it? Who bends it?
We do.
Who bends it?
We do.
All right.